principle of the bill is a share the wealth resource rebate. There are no restrictions on how the funds can be spent.
The Senate takes up the resource rebate payment. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 24th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a state application to take over an EPA pollutant program gets mixed reviews from the public.
With the federal, we have a door that we can open up. The state, we have one that gets closed in our face.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska.
State troopers are reporting last night a 911 call was received from the Kenai Princess Lodge stating employee Abby Sisk of Ogden, Utah was walking on a trail when she was attacked by a brown bear. Lodge visitor Wasilla resident Robert Van Zant heard the attack, looked out, and saw the bear standing on top of Sisk with her head in its jaws. He managed to chase the bear off. The bear is described as a very large male, standing 7 to 8 feet tall and between 500 to 800 pounds. Sisk suffered severe facial and head lacerations and was transported to Central Peninsula Hospital in Soldotna. She was later transferred to Providence Hospital in Anchorage, where she underwent emergency surgery this morning. Responding troopers were unable to locate the bear. The resource rebate bill the governor gave the special session ran into some problems today as the Senate Finance Committee began its review of the program that would give all Alaskans a one-time $1,200 check. APRN's Dave Donaldson has the story.
Talk about the bill never really got beyond the title. When the idea of distributing the money first arose in May, the governor presented it as an energy relief plan, a way of helping meet the high cost of energy. When it was introduced, though, it was called a resource rebate. The Finance Committee wanted to know what happened between those two ideas. Finance Chairman Republican Bert Stedman asked if the current bill is actually an energy relief program in disguise. Randy Ruaro, a special assistant on the governor's staff, said the states had a good income and the state treasury will end up with a surplus this year.
The principle of the bill is a share the wealth resource rebate. There are no restrictions on how the funds can be spent, but certainly if folks, and we think a lot of Alaskans would choose to spend them on energy-related costs or even investments.
Management and Budget Director Karen Rayfield said the program was proposed because of the effects on the public of the high prices that are making money for the state.
Our revenue situation is a blessing to the state of Alaska that's also providing significant hardship on Alaskans for the cost of oil. The one-time resource rebate or payment would certainly assist Alaskans in meeting some of those high energy costs while we work on a longer-term solution to reduce the cost of energy for the entire state.
The energy relief plan originally was to issue a $100 a month debit card that could only be used for energy-related purchases. Ruaro said that was a problem. It wouldn't have worked for 10 or 20% of the people who live in communities where no vendor could accept the cards. And the administration also got legal advice that some tax issues could have come up for people who got it. He said that's when they backed away from the original plan.
But the principle, the underlying principle has been consistent, which is share the wealth of the state. So the sideboards, I guess, have fallen away, but the underlying principles remain the same.
The two plans have caused confusion in the public's mind, though. Fairbanks Democrat Joe Thomas said people are now asking him about the inequity of the one-time payment, with no regard to the amount of fuel consumed, the differences in weather, or the cost of fuel in different parts of the state.
It makes it very difficult for me to explain to people, oh, well, now it's a different deal. You know, it's not energy relief anymore. It's simply a distribution of the resource wealth that we have on an individual basis, yet at the same time, we're talking about long-term, mid-term, and long-term solutions to the energy problem. So the energy keeps entering into it, continually anyhow.
Ruaro said the administration's been consistent in talking about sharing the state's revenue. He says what has fallen off is the restriction on how people must spend that money. He told the committee that people are still free to use the $1,200 to pay an electric bill or to purchase a new heating system. Further hearings will be held on the bill, but it hasn't been scheduled yet. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Janie Leisk is the president of the First Alaskans Institute. Leisk supports the resource rebate bill, saying something needs to happen before the first frost occurs. She said rural Alaska has a lot of needs right now.
And it's imperative that we as a state do something to meet those needs while at the same time looking to long-term solutions that I'm sure that you have all heard about.
She says the Institute did its own unscientific survey of rural Alaska economic conditions, compared them to Anchorage, and found those conditions to be poor by Western standards. She said their survey found electric rates ranging from 19 to 30 cents per kilowatt hour, while Anchorage pays about 9 to 10 cents for the same energy. Without power cost equalization, the villages would pay 50 cents per kilowatt hour. She said people now have to choose how to use their energy between heating their homes or gathering food. And she says subsistence is absolutely critical until subsistence food becomes more expensive than store-bought food.
This is an immediate problem. We can get lost in the weeds, but it's an immediate problem and the freeze-up is coming soon.
Leisk says the villages surveyed had heating fuel prices that ranged from $9 to $11 per gallon. A state plan to take over a major federal water quality program is drawing mixed reviews. Several industry groups support the change in managing the Clean Water Act's wastewater discharge program, but some environmental activists question whether it will give industry too much leeway. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Greens Creek Mine has dug silver, gold, zinc, and lead out of Admiralty Island west of Juneau for most of the past 20 years. That means it's had to pass regulatory muster to open, operate, and expand. Environmental advisor Bill O'Klaus says Greens Creek would likely benefit from the state taking over the Federal Clean Water Act's wastewater responsibilities.
For our mine and probably for the industry as a whole, the people writing and administering the permit would be Alaska-based, instead of being people from Seattle, and they would be considerably more familiar with the conditions and the programs that they're writing permits for and administering.
Officials in several other industries also want the State Department of Environmental Conservation to take over the Federal Environmental Protection Agency program. The oil industry, seafood processors, municipal sewer systems, mines, loggers, and major land developers need the permits. Alaska Forest Association Director Owen Graham of Ketchikan says the state will have a better understanding of on-the-ground operations.
The small log transfer facilities that we have scattered all over Alaska, where we put wood in the water, transfer logs in and out of the water, small quantities of wood. With the EPA, we have to get an individual permit. Once in a while, we can get a general permit that will cover those activities, but it's a pretty onerous process.
Some environmental groups say basing regulators in Alaska will make no difference. Clean water activist Gershon Cohen of Haines says EPA's Seattle office knows Alaska issues.
If anything, you know, there certainly is always the concern that having a person that may be more easy to be influenced by the industry could be a bad thing in terms of whether or not they're really doing their job, which is not to give permits to the industry to operate, but to protect the environment.
Others say the state has already given the industry too much of a role in the planned takeover of the wastewater program. Vicki Clark of Anchorage-based Trustees for Alaska says miners, loggers, and oil companies will have more power in the process than the general public.
DEC has used a working group that consists of industry folks who will be regulated under the program with no seat at the table for anyone else affected by the program. So it's been problematic for, you know, the conservation community and others to really be involved in the process until now with the public comment period.
Federal law passed 3 decades ago gave states the right to manage the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System program. Alaska is one of only 5 states not in charge. Department of Environmental Conservation officials say it's time to make that move. Water Division Director Lynn Kent says the system in place duplicates work.
under the current program, without the state being in charge of the permitting program, permit applications go to both EPA and DEC. All of the reporting under the permits go to two agencies. So under NPDES primacy, the industrial folks and the municipalities that have permits will only need to work with a single agency.
Federal officials will decide whether to approve the state's plan by November. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Public comment on the state's application was held in Anchorage last night. Around 17 people signed up to testify. All but two spoke against the transfer from the EPA to the state. Although most of the speakers were representing Native communities or organizations, most questioned the timing of a hearing on an issue important to tribes being held during the height of subsistence gathering. Billy Maines came to speak on behalf of the Cheruiyunk tribe in the Dillingham area. Maines says the tribe had asked for consultation with EPA over the state's application, but agreed to the public hearing. He says the tribe opposes the transfer because there is no dialogue between the state and tribes. He said talking about a pollutant discharge system under the Clean Water Act seems like an oxymoron.
There shouldn't be any discharge of any pollutant of any sort into any water. It should be there to clean the water. I'm from an area where the water is very essential. It's essential for all human and aquatic life in that area. So if there's any potential way of stopping permitting process period, Cheruiyunk Tribe would be in favor of it. We're not in favor of changing one for the other, from the federal to the state.
Roberta Chavez is the National Environmental Policy Act coordinator for the Association of Village Council Presidents in the Bethel YK Delta region. AVCP represents 56 federally recognized tribes, and Chavez had brought 10 tribal resolutions opposing the transfer.
We demand that EPA deny this request from the state of Alaska. That is a significant threat and a further erosion of our efforts to maintain long-term protection for our subsistence way of life as well as our cultural integrity.
Representatives from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, or AOGA, and the Resource Development Council spoke in favor of the state's application for the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System program. The public comment period closes on August 18th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, working to save the albatross.
If you're threatening an endangered species, you get shut down, period. Bango, gone.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Railroad Corporation, with daily rail service to Seward, Whittier, Anchorage, Talkeetna, Denali Park, and Fairbanks through mid-September. Information available at alaskarailroad.com. And by
Inlet Tower Hotel and Suites, offering banquets and catering services from private dining to business conferences to wedding banquets. Information on hotel amenities online at inlettower.com.
The Alaska Public Interest Research Group, AGPIRG, has released a report on the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, or AGIA. The report by independent industry analyst Richard Feinberg does not take sides on pipeline projects, but says AGIA provides no assurance for the state of a fair return on its natural gas. Feinberg says as leaseholders of the gas, North Slope producers will be in a position of control, even if TransCanada's project wins state support.
There's a real possibility when the producers own 95% of the gas that will be shipped, at least in the early stages, are they in a position to dictate terms to TransCanada despite all of the admirable provisions in the AGIA proposal that are supposed to deliver us low tariffs?
A low tariff is important to the state because it's subtracted from the price of the gas before major state taxes and royalties are applied. A low tariff means higher revenue for the state and also makes it more affordable for smaller companies to ship gas on a pipeline. High Trans Alaska oil pipeline tariffs have historically shortchanged the state and limited competition on the North Slope. Feinberg cautions that tariff provisions are very complex and easily misinterpreted.
Any single point in this tariff that process can be pulled out of context. There are good things in the TransCanada proposal. I am simply not clear that we have the context right, and I am clear that in many points on it, we seem to have the context wrong.
Feinberg says the unprecedented financial magnitude and international aspects of the project further complicate the TransCanada proposal. The Senate will hold hearings and may take a vote on the proposal next week. Golden Valley Electric Association officials have changed their mind about the Healy Clean Coal Plant. In a letter to members, the utility says it wants to buy the long-idled state-owned facility. Golden Valley had a contract with the Alaska Industrial Export Authority, or AIDA, to do so back in 2000, but backed out when the plant failed a performance evaluation. Utility spokeswoman Corrine Bradish says the high cost of oil is making the clean coal plant look better now. She says it's all about the economics.
That's actually where this started 8 years ago, is we felt the impact to our members' rates would have been very dramatic if we had taken a plant that was not going to run reliably and cost more, and be it from additional employees being needed and all that. Now with the economics changed, we feel that we can afford to take this on and add it to our diversified fuel mix.
Taking the plant now is not a simple proposition. A tangled legal situation has ensued in the 8 years since the Golden Valley originally rejected it. The complications included failed negotiations, a stalled deal with Homer Electric to take the plant, and AIDA suing Golden Valley for $167 million. AIDA attorney Charlie Cole says the fact that the clean coal plant sits on Golden Valley property has been a sticking point.
Basically, in the lawsuit, the fundamental premise is that AIDA wants the court to order GVA to grant AIDA a lease for those premises so that AIDA can get underway with its efforts to put the plant into operation. AIDA is anxious, very anxious, to reach agreement with the GVEA.
AIDA and Golden Valley officials hammered out a 200-page settlement that included a lease for the state last year, but Golden Valley Board of Directors failed to approve it this spring. Golden Valley's Bradish says that's allowed AIDA's lawsuit to move ahead.
The judge did set a trial date for late 2009, but we're hoping that will never happen, that other avenues can be looked at.
Bradish says the plant needs an estimated $15 million of work to repair deficiencies and recommission it for service. She says Golden Valley is prepared to pay for the work if it can work out a purchase deal with the state. She says the governor's energy plan could be a potential cash source to help the deal along. Researchers at UAA have devised a safer and more energy-efficient way to guide planes in rural Alaska. Eli Meneker has more.
The FAA Center of Excellence for General Aviation has completed a project partnering teams from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, the University of North Dakota, and the University of Alaska Anchorage. The researchers created a system to improve the safety of nighttime landings at small airports with an innovative remote airport light system. Michael Inman, a pilot and a researcher with UAA's technology division at Merrill Field, says that in addition to increasing safety at small airports, the new lighting system should also reduce energy costs for bush communities.
They basically ask us to conduct a study of available lighting technologies, trying to see if we could come up with a lighting system that would have, in this case, an application in remote Alaska, a place that would probably be difficult to acquire power from. And we're hoping that the application will be used for one of the mining communities that are out there that maybe only have one or two small commercial flight operations a week or something like that, that they could basically still have a night landing system that could be used for visual night landing, and at the same time, significantly reduce the power consumption or the power cost for using that type of system.
The low-cost, highly portable system uses LED lights and retroreflective markers to guide planes to the runway. Villages with no airstrip lighting would be able to use the portable system during night or winter emergencies, such as medevac flights. Another positive is the substantial cost difference. Traditional lighting can cost as much as $1 million, while the portable lighting only costs around $3,000, making it ideal for rural Alaska, where the need can be great, but the resources limited.
In the world of aviation, and you know, the one of the rules is more is better. So the brighter the light, the more of them, you know, that kind of thing. That's always a good thing. But you know, if we're in a place where we don't have access to power, using this retroreflective type system, I think a lot of pilots will be kind of pleasantly surprised, because it really does give you what you need as far as a pilot for a night VFR landing, a safe night VFR landing.
The system will be put in place later this summer at small Anchorage and Matsu Valley airstrips and tested through December. In Anchorage, I'm Eli Miniker.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fndalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This spring, 10 short-tailed albatross chicks were kidnapped from their nest on a remote Japanese island, then sent 300 miles away to a new home. The ambitious project to translocate the endangered birds began more than 10 years ago when a fishing boat off Alaska caught one on a long line. APRN's Jessica Cochran has more.
In 1995, Thorne Smith was working for the North Pacific Longliners Association when he got a call from a scientist friend.
He said, "Hey, Thorne, you guys just caught a short-tailed albatross. It's an endangered species. You better look out."
At that time, the last known count of the birds was from 1962, when the population was estimated at only 300. Smith was alarmed.
"If you're threatening an endangered species, you get shut down, period. Bango, gone."
Soon, the fleet came up with regulations requiring them to deploy streamers, or tory lines, on their boats to keep the birds from getting hooked as they tried to steal bait. And that has worked. Longline fishermen in Alaska haven't hooked a bird since 1998, but the albatrosses face another problem.
"These things live on this active volcano called Torishima, which means Bird Island, and it went off in 2002. Up half of the birds were not on the island. They're only there about half the year. But the Japanese scientists say that eventually it's going to go off when the birds are nesting there."
Torishima Island is the nesting site for the majority of the population. Scientists say it's due for a major eruption. But it's not just that it's volcanic. The nesting site is also steep. Heavy rains can wash eggs out to sea. Sometimes they just roll off. That's why, this past February, Rob Surian found himself hiking up a steep cliff on Torishima Island with two chicks strapped to his back. Not little chicks. They weighed between 8 and 11 pounds each. Surian says they're shaped like Hershey's Kisses. They were cozied into specially designed boxes with ventilation holes, their temperatures monitored constantly, and their human porters walked slowly, carefully, to avoid jostling them too much.
"When you handle them or approach them, they often will just regurgitate their stomach contents. And we did not want that to occur in the boxes, because we wanted the chicks to keep what food they had, but also the regurgitation is often filled with very concentrated oils from fish oils, and that, as you can imagine, would really soil the feathers."
The idea is to try to establish another breeding colony on Mukojima Island. It's not volcanic and is protected for conservation. The Japanese have placed albatross decoys and play recordings of albatross calls to try to attract adult birds there to nest. But the birds return to breed where they were raised. So the 10 chicks from Torishima were flown by helicopter to Mukojima to be raised there by humans. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist Judy Jacobs helped with the chicks on Mukojima.
"She's holding the beak of the chick open. You can see it's just a regular caulking gun that we load with, in this case, chopped or minced fish and vitamins made into a slurry with a Cuisinart, basically, and fill up the tube and just cock it right into the chick."
The chicks were between 4 and 6 weeks old when they were moved. Biologists hope that is just old enough that the birds will have imprinted and self-identified as albatrosses, but still give them almost 3 months in their new home before they take flight.
"And we're hoping that during that time they will actually imprint, if you will, on the location where they're being reared rather than where they were hatched."
For 2 years, Japanese and American scientists worked together, practicing raising albatross chicks with different species to get their technique down. This year's transfer of the short-tailed albatross chicks was big news in Japan. The effort was sponsored by a beer company, and the chicks' progress was covered by major newspapers and television stations. For 2.5 months, crews rotated through, carefully feeding the chicks, weighing them, and getting them ready to fledge. which they did between May 18th and 23rd, just a little earlier than their naturally raised counterparts on Torashima.
To me, it seems like they were so well-fed and they were just so healthy that they were actually able to fledge a little bit earlier than the naturally reared chicks.
Five of the translocated chicks and five from Torashima were fitted with transmitters, so researchers can track their progress. Their position is recorded 6 times a day, and every 3 days, the data is uploaded via satellite. Rob Surian keeps close tabs on them.
They're like young kids on the move. It's amazing how fast they travel and how much they wander and how much ground they cover each week. So it's always exciting to log in and see where the birds have gone in the past few days.
So far, the results are promising. 2 died early on, 1 from each group. But that's not surprising. They usually have a 75% survival rate. They're scattered across the Bering Sea, the Aleutians, and Russia's Kuril Islands. And the chicks raised by people are following the same migration patterns as the rest of the chicks. They're still acting like albatrosses, despite being fed by human hands. It will be another 4 or 5 years before scientists know whether the experiment worked. That's when these birds should return to breed. The scientists hope they'll return to their new home on Mukajima Island. For APRN, I'm Jessica Cochran.
Earlier this week, the Kodiak City Council got an update on plans for the new police station and jail project. KMXT's Casey Kelly has more.
The latest roadblock for the project has been the skyrocketing cost of construction, with the most recent estimate putting the overall price tag at about $22.8 million. Earlier this month, the city council rejected Freed's proposal to raise the sales tax on alcohol to make up for about a $6 million shortfall on the project. The city manager's latest idea is to build the police station but leave the jail portion unfinished until additional funds from the state of Alaska can be secured.
So at this point, the estimate for completing the entire project would be roughly $18.5 million.
The city council has directed Freed to write a letter to the state asking for more money to complete the jail portion of the project, since the city's jail is a regional facility that houses prisoners from multiple jurisdictions. Freed reiterated that this wasn't the way she preferred to complete the project, but with the rising cost of construction affecting every aspect, she felt it was the best way to proceed at this time.
This is the one that I think best serves the community and best serves the direction that the city council has given me. And so we're moving forward with this one right now. We're hopeful that it won't come in any higher.
Once the police station is built and until funds can be secured to complete the jail, Freed said the city could continue to operate the jail at the current location for a period of time. But once that building becomes too run down to operate anymore, the city will be forced to use temporary holding cells in the new station. The city council was noncommittal with Freed's plan. Members said they would look at the completed design for the proposed police station without the finished jail and decide then if it was worth putting out to bid. Freed said the plans were about 2 weeks away from being finished. I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Casey Kelly in Kodiak. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, and Jessica Cochran and Eli Meneker from Anchorage. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. Our webmaster is John Prophet. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Chariot Group, an authorized Polycom partner featuring HD conferencing solutions from its new conference center in Anchorage. Information at chariotgroup.com.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.